The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, good morning to you. How are you? Did you miss me?
Boker Tov, welcome back. Sure, we missed you, Howard, although we had a very, very able replacement in your stead.
Certainly.
And we all wished for you to have a very good break from the hard work that you do in the early morning. So we hope that you'd at least manage to achieve that.
Absolutely.
Even though you needed to get out of the gate before 6 o'clock, but whatever. hopefully you were at least taking a break. And of course, while you were away, lots and lots of activity here in Israel. Two little things before we get into the meaty bits. The first of which is that there's been a letter written from the Prime Minister's office to the person who is the group, the entity that's responsible for managing the Kotel prayer area. And the letter to the letter from the Prime Minister's office says that there should not be any gender separation barriers, any mechitzot, erected in the egalitarian prayer section. Now, all of that has a lot of nuance and innuendo behind it, because as people who have visited the Kotel will know, the main prayer area at the Kotel, in the outside area in the plaza, is separated into gender separate areas, one for men, one for women. That's always been the case, and that's been the traditional stance taken by the chief rabbi of the Kotel and the group that administers the area. There's been pressure placed upon the Kotel administration as well as the government to allow people who don't wish to separate by gender to go and to be able to pray at the Kotel together. And of course, this style of prayer is very common in certain strains of Judaism, Reform and Conservative and many other strains of Judaism. They are accustomed to praying together and not gender separated. And they felt that they were excluded by not having a place that they could do their form of prayer at the Kotel. Of course, this was all very much objected to by the chief rabbi of the Kotel and by the administration that is responsible for taking care of the Kotel area. But eventually, the Prime Minister's office intervened, and an egalitarian area has been established at the southern end of the Kotel to allow those people who wish to pray together to do so. And my personal view is that I think that everybody should have the right to do whatever they wish without imposing upon others what they would wish them to do. So if you want to pray separately, by all means, go to the gender-separated area and do that. If you want to pray together, then you're able to do that too. And I don't think that that necessarily contradicts anything that anybody believes, except the fact that ultra-Orthodox organizations, groups, have really taken it upon themselves to try somehow to sabotage the egalitarian area. And they have started their own prayers at the egalitarian area. They've brought in gender separation dividers, mechitzot, in order to try to separate them so that they can impose their will on that particular area. So again, the Prime Minister's office has had to intervene and has had to order that no mechitzot be brought into the egalitarian area. I mean, this story even goes a bit further than that, because unfortunately, some of these ultra-Orthodox activists have actually even disrupted bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah services that have been going on in that egalitarian era, forcing on one occasion at least the Prime Minister to phone the family who had come specially from the United States to celebrate a bar mitzvah, and whose bar mitzvah was interrupted by activists who went in and tore up the prayer books and interrupted the service. The Prime Minister's office called to apologize to those individuals for the fact that their ceremony that they'd specially come all the way from the US to celebrate had been spoiled. But now, formally, a note has gone out to say no mechitzot in the gender egalitarian area where everybody can mix together. What do the listeners think about that?
Yep, I'd love to hear. 34519 or 0618951019. In fact, my column this week in the Jewish Report deals exactly with this issue. I've expressed my view in the form of a column as well on this very, very subject. Prime Minister Yair Lapid met yesterday with Jordan's King Abdullah, and that's for the first time since becoming a prime minister. Do we know what was on the agenda for the meeting?
Well, if we read back the reports from the Jordanian side and from the Israeli side on the meeting, you might be taken in to believe that there were two separate meetings, one which Yair Lapid attended and one which King Abdullah attended, and that they probably weren't the same meeting together, because the reports seem to be so different as to exactly what went down in the meeting. The Jordanian report suggests that King Abdullah focused on the two-state solution issue, that he re-emphasized that no Middle East agreements can be reached without coming to an agreement with the Palestinians, without reaching a two-state solution settlement. That was really the emphasis from the Jordanian side. If we read back the Israeli version of the story, then this was really all about trying to promote economic activity, trying to get Jordan back involved in some of the economic activity that's really regional cooperation that's really been engendered partially as a result of the Abraham Accords, but not only. And one of the things that has been quite noticeable in recent weeks and months is the fact that Jordan is becoming a little bit isolated as Israel progresses in developing relationships with other Arab countries. So, for example, Jordan was noticeably left off the agenda when the U.S. president visited the area. He spoke to the Israeli government. He even visited with the Palestinian Authority and had meetings with them. And, of course, he then went on to Saudi Arabia, where he met with various leaders involved with oil production, particularly in the Middle East. And the Jordanians seem to have kind of been left off the agenda. Add to that the fact that with Israel and Saudi Arabia agreeing to open a direct flight route for those Muslims who wish to do the Hajj next year, there will be direct flights, we are told, from Israel to Mecca. What that has done is it's effectively isolated Jordan once again, because the route that the Hajjis have used up until now to fly to Mecca has been through Jordan. So Jordan is now taken out of that particular equation and potentially being left isolated. So it was interesting that the Israeli version of the story discussed opportunities to expand bilateral ties on food, on security, on agriculture, on transportation, and particularly emphasizing this Jordan Gateway Industrial Park that Israel and Jordan have been putting together in order to try somehow to expand the Jordanian part of the economic relationship with Israel. But for some reason, that particular side of the discussion, if indeed it did take place, was completely left off the Jordanian report, which really just focused more about the Palestinian issue than anything else.
It is understandable, though, given the intricacy with which Jordan has been involved in this conflict. You know, Jordan itself lost land during the Six-Day War. That became part of the so-called West Bank. There's been a lot of criticism of Jordan and how they failed to integrate those who fled Israel in 1948. So Jordan is much, there's a lot more baggage there compared to, for example, the Saudi Arabias and other countries.
Undoubtedly. I mean, I think Jordan has got a few things that work against it. The first of which is exactly what you've mentioned, the fact that there's still so many Palestinian refugees who've not been integrated into Jordanian society. So why is it that Jordan is standing up for the rights of the Palestinians as they do without being willing to at least integrate those who are in their own territory into their society? They're very much kept separate from things. Having said that, Jordan has been very vocal in trying to support the Palestinian cause, perhaps in order to get those Palestinian refugees moved over to what they would consider to be a new Palestinian. So maybe there's some sort of an ulterior motive there. Of course, Jordan has the role as the Waqf leader, because King Abdullah, of course, is the head of the Waqf, the head of the council that rules the Muslim holy sites in Jerusalem. So he enjoys some sort of a status amongst Muslims around the world in that particular role. But I think the one key problem that Jordan experiences, that it has no natural resources to speak of and no natural burgeoning economy. Their economic activity just seems to be stagnant, and there doesn't seem to be any success in somehow finding an alternative to the fact that there is a lack of natural resources in Jordan, and to try somehow to encourage Jordanians to create a separate economy. When Israel was first created, it's a great example of building a high-tech industry, building things that don't come naturally, because at that time, at least, Israel didn't enjoy any natural resources. Subsequent to that, of course, Israel has been fortunate enough to find these gas reserves, but that wasn't the case originally. And yet, Israel managed to find a way to create an economy, tourism, high-tech, technology, whatever, various water, different ways of trying to create an economic activity. Jordan has unfortunately failed where that is concerned.
So, it will be interesting to see how this evolves. Two more parties have decided to run together in the upcoming election. Give us some context here.
So we have not a merger of two parties, but just an agreement to run together. And interestingly enough, this is the Yamina Party under control of Ayelet Shaked. And just for those who are not familiar with it, the Yamina Party is actually former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's party. He was at the head of Yamina until he decided not to run in the upcoming election. And that's now been taken over by his partner in crime, someone who has partnered him for already some years, Ayelet Shaked. She has taken over leadership of Yamina. And yesterday she agreed to run together with the party called Derech Eretz, which is under the leadership of current Communications Minister Yoaz Hendel. So it is Derech Eretz and Yamina who will be running together. And their new tag that they're using, their new tagline that they're using to label their party is called Haruach HaTzionit, the Zionist Spirit. That's the name of the party that they're using, the name at least that they're going to run under in the upcoming election. Why have they decided to run together? It's a relatively simple piece of math to do, because each party was at risk of not being able to get enough votes in order to pass the minimum threshold required to get any seats in the Knesset. Both of them were really on the threshold when looking at the recent opinion polls. They were each on the threshold of not being represented at all in the upcoming Knesset after the next election. And so by joining together, they feel that they're able to somehow at least secure each of the parties some representation in the Knesset by joining their votes together. Whether, in fact, one can take one plus one and say, therefore, that they will get two instead of only one each, which won't be enough, is difficult to understand, because I think that there are some people who are looking at this partnership and saying it doesn't feel comfortable. And therefore we won't vote for it. But I think on the whole, it's probably going to guarantee them a representation in the upcoming Knesset. The interesting thing for me was what they said about what they represent or don't represent at yesterday's signing ceremony. And unfortunately, they didn't say anything positive about what they do want. There was a lot of talk about what they don't want and what they're not prepared to tolerate and what they won't support, but very, very little about what they will support and what they do want and how they see their vision after the next election. So it's one of these classic cases of it's very, very easy to articulate all the things that are negative and that you wouldn't be willing to tolerate. But there is no view at the moment about what it is that they really do want.
I would say that, you know, from as an outside observer, that does speak quite a lot to Israeli politics at the moment. Is it's true. Less about selling a dream or selling a vision. The last couple of elections were all about the negative in anybody but Netanyahu. It wasn't about a positive vision for the future. That kind of maybe came later with this coalition government that people thought, ooh, here's the ability to achieve something positive. Obviously, that then went the way that it went. But Israeli politics at the moment isn't particularly positive in terms of vision.
I agree. It's very, very easy to articulate all the things that you don't want. And they were very clear to say they're not willing to support a very narrow right-wing government that could potentially fire the Attorney General and stop the current case against Netanyahu. They're not willing to support a left-wing government that will include Arab parties and that will rely on Arab parties in order to keep the Knesset alive. So what do you want? Yeah, what is the answer
there? Who are you? Yeah, it's very, very interesting, and I think the party that comes up with a positive vision right now is going to be someone who stands ahead of the rest. We don't have a lot of time, but Israel has received its first shipment of monkeypox vaccinations. How will it be distributed? What is the current situation in Israel?
So we have a new pandemic, apparently, officially. And Israel has received 5,600 monkeypox doses that arrived early yesterday morning. The first shots are already expected to be rolled out by this coming weekend to those people considered most at risk of contracting the virus. And it's very, very interesting to see who those people are that are considered to be most at risk. So according to the official notification of this, and I'm just quoting, the vaccine will be given to men born after 1980 who are HIV positive or are taking pre-exposure prophylaxis medication to reduce their chance of contracting HIV. That is officially the first group of people who will be entitled to get the vaccine, and also apparently people who have tested positive for any STDs recently. They are considered to be a high priority as well for this particular vaccine. You all, of course, are able to draw your own conclusions as you see fit.
Very, very interesting to see how this is being targeted. Anthony Rach, that was way, way too quick. I felt like we needed more time, but either way, we get to do this next week. I wish you a fantastic weekend, a Shabbat Shalom, and we, of course, will catch you on Monday morning.